worst enemy of the human being. It makes us not being able to see the beautiful things that are surrounding us. It makes us not realizing the good things that are happening in our lives. While we continue our sometimes not exciting and so-called modern life, some people come to remind us of the treasures we have and remove the dust of oblivion of the jewels that we keep in the basement of our houses. Lena is a German girl who recently published a book called Behind the Closed Curtains, which reminds us that it is possible to dust off our traditional home elements, remodel them, and give them a modern look, and create a daring, bold, and lively interior design. What Lena has recorded in her book is only a sample of the historical background of using decorations in Iranian interior design and architecture, which is rooted in combination of Iranian culture, religion, and art. And it has evolved as time passes by. As a matter of fact, Iranian houses were a place for development of spirit and physical calmness. There is one thing in common between us and Lena. We both use this camera to record interesting events and life stories. Lena and her team traveled all over Iran and took their camera behind the closed curtains of Iranian houses. They shot photos and recorded lifestyles, decorations, and designs that are somehow modern, but have roots in our history. Something that was not possible a couple of hundred years ago, but Lena wants to make sure she produces something that can be used as a reference for future generations, something that shows where and how some Iranians live in the 21st century.
I was a student of Middle Eastern Studies politics back in Germany, and was learning some Farsi, the Farsi of the books. And I wanted to learn the proper Farsi of the streets and really get to know the country itself. Traveling in Iran, I understood that, okay, there is something in Iran we don't have that way so much. We also have it in Europe, but not in that way, which is handicrafts. So what I understood is like, okay, handicrafts, that's something everyone can relate to because it is interior design, it is decoration. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a house you have to decorate. So that's where I started. I thought, okay, also in Iran, there will be people who decorate their house and decorate them in a nice way, even if they're probably not interior designers. Mm-hmm.
What makes Iranian decorative elements more special is that they're timeless. You always find some shining aspects in them, something to fall in love with.
I think it's really cool when you're mixing something from old and bringing it into the modernity. So this is, for example, what Murtaza did here with these henna stones, which are traditionally used to paint you place the feet on it the night before you're getting married, and then you got the henna painted on the feet. So this was the original use, but what Murtaza did, he copied them and use them as basically the feet for a coffee table. It is used outside of the religious context. It's decoration. And I think it is really a beautiful and impressive piece, especially, of course, with all the feathers in this pink, fleshy color, contrasting to the white of the house. In Iranian culture, I mean, there is the flower as a topic is really important. So what we see here is like a lale, actually it's a light, which means also in Persian the flower. And here I think it's really nice the shape you find throughout Iran. These either candles or nowadays also they work with electricity. But it's a soft shape. So again, it's a curve like in Iranian architecture you find a lot.
Amir Hossein is an Iranian artist inspired by his roots. What is more felt at his house is a daring innovation that definitely comes from a character full of taste and art. What he does is to introduce another usage for the elements of Persian architecture and art, and thus let us see beyond the ordinary and normal elements of our life. Center yard with a pond in the middle, which is surrounded by rooms with different usages during different seasons of a year. At the first glance, you think this is a typical Iranian traditional house. But for sure, it is nothing like my grandparents' house. From what I remember, many decorative and architectural elements are the same, but they're being used very differently. And this creativity is certainly part of the beauty of this house. Decorating your house is definitely not a piece of cake, especially when you're looking for some very unique items that are infused with Persian culture and our traditions. But remember that there's an artist inside of every one of us. An artist that knows what is beautiful and what is not. An artist that knows how to put things together. But we don't necessarily have the creativity to make these decorative items. And for that reason, people in places like here made our lives easy. You just need to come here and see all these beautiful items. Pick what you love. Make sure that it goes good with your other stuff and make sure that it fits your personality.
Stores like this are the results of a recently started movement by some young Iranians who renovate old houses and decorate them with antique-like and traditional decorative items. I'm very inspired by all these amazing stuff and looking forward to use them to decorate my own house sometime soon.
I should say this is the happiest day of my life because I published a book on interior design in Iran and this is the final day, the book presentation. I feel super happy. I'm super exhausted too because it has been hard work. I've gone through a lot of ups and downs in the last 8 months, but I feel proud to now say, okay, I published a book, this is the book, and I'm a writer. And I've done something for Iran, a country I really love, and I started with the purpose to show a different Iran to the world, and I think I achieved it.
And Iran is a mysterious land. Every corner of it and every aspect of it is a book with thousands of pages, with beautiful images and amazing stories. Shahriyar Azimi for Iran.
Whatever I will be, I don't need to be what you need me to be, yeah. I thank God for what he's done for me. You give me so much light and you make me feel invincible.
Allah's love has no limits. Allah's love has no boundaries. For every raindrop that falls, for every ray of sunshine, for everything is under His control. You cannot see Allah, you cannot touch Allah, but you can feel Allah. He is there in every tear that falls, in every smile that shows. Allah is all around us. I am whatever I may be, but Allah has already planned my destiny.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints with me, Atta, the host of this program. Shaykh Hussein and Sister Zainab are over here in today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, and assalam alaikum to your dear listeners.
Wa alaykum assalam, brother, and to all the listeners.
Okay, the crisis in Sudan, a devastating conflict, a complex one. When you look at the footage and the videos of the people who are being massacred over there, it's really harsh. And some people might ask, what's the main reason? As long as the peace treaty between Hamas and Israel is signed, Sheikh Latifi, something else, another complex, another thing is going to happen in another part of the world. This time, Sudan, okay? The so-called people who were after peacemaking is Sudan. For example, one of them, this lady, Ala Salah, for example, you know, she was famous on that time. Where is she now? She's living in her cozy place in London and does not say anything about Sudan crisis. Give us a background, a history of what took place in Sudan and what is taking place in Sudan now.
Okay, we always need to have some perspective about what's taking place politically. And in Sudan, in the case of Sudan, if I want to simplify it and hopefully not oversimplify it, you know, after the Islamic Revolution in Iran, some Muslim countries, they were inspired by this revolution, okay? And not just by being Islamic, by being anti-Western, anti-colonial, anti-Israel.
All right.
And one of these nations, they were Sudanese nation. The Sudanese, 10 years after the Islamic Revolution in Iran, they had this chance to have some changes in their policies. And then Omar al-Bashir came to power. And Omar al-Bashir, he had all the things that the West didn't like. He allied with Iran. He was anti-Zionist. He wanted independence of Sudanese resources. And then, as it happens, the West does not. The West does not like a player in the region like this.
And Sudan was safe, isn't it?
Yes.
There was no civil war or something. Peace was over there, isn't it?
Oh, yes. You always have political, social divide.
Yeah, conflicts are over
there. Any nations. Okay. Like in U.S., you don't have social divide. You have social divide. Okay. Let me tell you something. There was this interview with the former CIA head that I was listening to. The guy said that we do not start a divide in nations. What we do is called lever strategy. You know what lever is? Something that they put in a crack and they open it and enlarge it.
Yeah.
So I said that we find a divide, we put our lever there, and we do not allow it to heal. Okay? This is what they do.
Wow.
So they did it in Syria. They're trying to do it in Iran because you have social divide over hijab, over whatever here and there.
Yes.
In Sudan, because of the tribal background and everything, you had social divide there. So, but it was a functioning country. It was the breadbasket of Africa. Sudan, like Syria. Syria before like 10, 15 years ago, Syria was a role model for independent Arab nation, flourishing economy, everything good.
Yes.
And then they just made it collapse. They destroyed it.
You know that according to the statistics, the tourism industry was the most profitable industry in the whole Arab regions, okay, in Syria.
Yeah, I remember the time that our friends, we would go there.
Both for religious things and for, we can say, ancient, antique things, you know, they go, that's right.
So Sudan, in the African context, after Libya, was a flourishing, good country. Then, because the only crime that they had was they were anti-Zionist after Omar al-Bashir. So they started demonizing Omar al-Bashir, this dictator, this, that. And people in these countries, they have problems. I'm not saying Omar al-Bashir was infallible or whatever.
Okay.
No, people, they have problems. Yes. And also people had sufferings. But some of the sufferings were the results of the sanctions that the West had imposed. So they create this mentality, this calculation for the youth. You have problems, and the source of the problem is this guy. If you topple this, we're going to lift the sanction and everything.
All right.
So with this calculation, and then you had some problem about the prices going up because of the sanctions and everything.
Yes. Inflation.
Yes. Right. So people, they came to the conclusion, okay, let's get rid of this dictatorship, and we want freedom. As you said, that lady, you always have the humanitarian thing that they have it.
Allah Salah, that's
right. As if they care. Now, I mean, the Americans, they care about humanitarian issues. It's funny. Okay. Even if it's very naive to think that they care about these things.
Okay.
So they toppled Omar al-Bashir. They call it a, for example, democratic revolution or whatever, which was orchestrated, I believe, from afar, and also some elements, internal elements. Anyways, so after that, then the problems started. Currently, what we have in Sudan, we have two military groups. One of them is called RSF, Rapid Support Forces, and the other is Sudanese Armed Forces, SAF.
Yes.
So Sudanese Armed Forces are the remaining of the central government military, and then you have RSF, which is a militia created initially by the government in order to take control of, because we have a geographical situation in Sudan, some areas the central government cannot control, and they have to have other militias controlling. Anyways, they started this, but it is out of their control now. Not that it is out of their control, they have become like a proxy for external
forces,
powers.
That's right.
Like UAE and the US, because of the resources. The other thing that you have is that nations with natural resources, they are good victim for the ambitions of these powers.
That's right.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
So resource control is one of them, and Sister Zainab, we can't say, in terms of the atrocities that are taking place over there, you know, the children being killed, the ladies, you know, being killed, and we see the footages are very much the same as the Israel one. It seems, I could see the footsteps of Israel over there too, okay? Yeah. The level of violence, Sister Zainab, over there. Okay, so what's your take on that?
Yes, obviously. I'm sure that many people have actually viewed these obviously satellite images that are going around. Apparently there was, I think, a 500-day siege on the city, a town called El Fasha.
Yeah, El Fasha.
And obviously it's, and people, even Western sort of commentators are saying that this is genocide. So I think it was Canada's former ambassador to Sudan, his name is Nicholas Coughlin, said that genocide is unfolding. And he actually says that it's not being forgotten, but it's deliberately marginalised. But obviously now everyone is able to view these images. And they're actually, some of the Western commentators are actually comparing the scale of this genocide just because of these images, that it must be like Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And obviously all of us probably, when we hear the word Rwanda, we just think of horrible, the most abhorrent genocide. Even obviously now, even at the moment still, we've got the big genocide on, still happening in Gaza, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, and just going back to obviously what Sheikh Latifi said, these things happen, of course. So if a country decides to stand against the West, if it's a small, unimportant country that doesn't really do much, but it just is against the Zionists and the Western regimes, fair enough. But this country, Sudan, is obviously one of Africa's richest countries in terms of natural resources. It's one of the world's top countries for gold, for sesame, peanuts. And obviously, as Sheikh said, just the way Syria actually is, had probably now destroyed very fertile agricultural land. Mm-hmm. This is the same in Sudan. So it's this fight over the resources. And we must draw attention and we must mention UAE, what the UAE is doing. And obviously we've even got sort of Canadian companies, I think, who actually also have, what would we call them, manufacturing houses are actually based in the UAE. And even so, Canadian companies are manufacturing arms for the RSF? I forget their name.
Yes.
And then also I've read that the UK is obviously delivering arms to UAE, which will then go on to this. So it's the same thing that is happening in Gaza. You know, the West, which has its arms industries, mm-hmm. is happily sending everything there. Mm. Again, especially now, full knowledge of what genocide is unfolding.
Yeah, talking about the full knowledge, yes. There's this humanitarian research lab in Yale University. Uh-huh. And I was listening to a person from there, nice guy, talking, and he said that from 2023, we have been warning the U.S. government that from the satellite imagery and the analysis that we have, something bad is going to happen. Mm-hmm. So he said, so far we have issued 60 warnings. Mm-hmm. Every month, two warnings to the U.S. Secretary of State and everything, international relations, that take care of what is going on with RSF. But they have turned a blind eye completely, mm-hmm. to the point that this person from Yale University, gentleman, academic, said, we finished our contract with the government.
All right.
And I would say that this is very naive from an American citizen to think that his government is caring about human rights.
Okay.
And he was questioning why our government is turning a blind eye over RSF. Mm-hmm. Because RSF is doing what it's doing in line with the American interests. Mm-hmm. Like the way Saddam was gassing Iranians, yes. and U.S. would not do anything,
no.
waiting for the right time, just when everybody there gets killed, and then we go there and get the
Halabja crisis. You're
yes.
talking about.
That's so
right.
This is what okay. they do. So RSF is the ISIS in Sudan, mm-hmm. uh-huh. something that was created initially for something else. It turned into something else, but all the way along, the U.S. is just monitoring the situation, and these people are telling, okay, do something. Stop, tell UAE. When that gentleman said, okay, mm-hmm. the Ankara asked him, okay, what should we do? He said, UAE is the ally of U.S. U.S. can tell UAE, okay, stop funding these people. Mm-hmm. But again, this is naive from this, because they have this pattern repeating itself to destabilize flourishing nations in the region, mm-hmm. especially if they are anti-Zionist. And
is it so? I mean, the volunteers over there and the groups that are talking are really anti-Zionist?
The background is this.
Uh-huh, okay.
Like, maybe now, no.
Okay.
Like Syria.
But the UAE supporters are now for sure.
No. Okay. No, they are in line.
That's
yes.
right.
This is actually what, you know, the central government, when they failed, when you had the divide South Sudan, North Sudan,
yes.
they accepted this. They accepted the normalization with Israel. All of these they accepted.
Okay.
But the sanctions were not lifted.
Uh-huh.
Why? Because U.S. is not going to lose its leverage against nations.
All right.
Okay. The leverage is, even if you're allies with the U.S., U.S. always reserves some leverage against you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, no, these RSF, they don't have anything against Israel. But because the central government had this background, they don't want Sudan to be independent.
All right.
Powerful.
That's right. So, as you said, the RSF controls many, or we can't say,
The yes. western part, Darfur and okay. Al-Fashir, yes.
The gold parts, you know.
Yes.
and these lucrative gold, we can say mines, are really important over here because both groups try to have control over there.
Yes, there's this record that says 40% or some of the gold that is sold in by UAE,
mm-hmm.
okay, is not registered. to being bought from normal markets.
Normal
it
markets.
It comes from Sudan.
You mean illegal?
Yes, yes. So somebody in the UK had done this research that this gold that comes from there, for at least 40% of it, maybe even more has been with the laundry that they do, okay? Gold laundry. Maybe they more, but at least 40% of it is just coming from the black market there.
That's right. From the smuggling routes, you call it. That's right. All right. Okay. So in terms of the humanitarian aid or something, does anyone do anything for these people over there, Sister Zainab?
I haven't even been aware of that. I haven't seen anything in the news about that happening. I think there's...
Because they are silent, you know, when you look at the mainstream media, mostly they are silent.
But what is happening, obviously, it's the same sort of propaganda. I can't call it war, but the same propaganda is happening about Sudan that was happening and still going on, even with regard to Gaza.
Yes.
So, for example, and we know that UAE, which is basically aligned with the Zionists, and which many Western governments support because they have such close ties with the UAE, they're obviously portraying, for example, the army of Sudan. They're calling it the Hamas of Africa.
Yes.
'Cause they want to sort of somehow justify what they're doing. They want to create this strange
these
image again.
They use whenever they like.
Okay.
After the project's finished, they bring that guy, like they would use label of terrorist for Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
And now you see the Al-Qaeda guy in White House.
Yeah, in White House, yeah.
These labels, they have a function.
Yesterday, $10,000 for his head, and now he is welcomed, and all sanctions are removed. And this is a funny irony of the modern world. In front of the eyes of everybody, recorded history, you know, you could see that. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Wes, for showing your true faith through a good president to us. And thank you very much. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Sheikh Hussein, for a nice elaboration, and Sister Zaina for a nice elaboration. What's taking place in Sudan is really harsh, you know. We can call it Second Palestine or Second Syria or something, you know. But every day, footsteps of the West are over there. We can't say what is over there is violence, what is over there is destruction and atrocity. And this is the legacy of the West everywhere. Thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
I know that you could easily take away everything you've given me. And I try to remember not to take anything for granted. 'Cause I know that one day, suddenly, this will all come to an end. So my last wish is for you to be pleased with me.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين. is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be asking a very important question, and that question is related to one of the stages of the hereafter. As you know, the hereafter has various stages or stopping points, which we call manazil in Arabic, which begin with death and then continue all the way up to, the gathering in the hereafter, and then the weighing of the good deeds and bad deeds of a person. One of the stations of the hereafter, the akhirat, is the grave or the qabr. When a person enters, once a person dies, he's taken into the grave. One of the things that will happen is that he will be questioned about certain things related to his life. And in fact, this is the first stage, or, maybe if we don't consider death the first stage, of the hereafter. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "The grave is the first station of the hereafter. If one is saved from it, whatever comes after it is easier. And if he is not saved from it, whatever comes after it is no less difficult than it." The question we want to ask today with respect to this topic is, what are the things that a person will be questioned about when he goes into the grave? In this regards, we can take inspiration from some of the hadith which have been passed down to us from the infallibles regarding this topic. In general, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, with regards to this verse of the Holy Quran, "Allah fortifies those who have faith with an immutable word in the life of this world and in the hereafter." The Prophet said this is regarding the grave when the dead are interrogated, meaning if somebody had faith in this world, when he goes into the grave and he's asked about, the things we're going to mention, Allah will help him and assist him at that time. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "A dead person will be questioned about five things: his prayer, the salat; his alms tax, meaning the zakat; his obligatory pilgrimage, the hajj; his fasting, the sawm; and his acceptance of our divine guardianship, acceptance of the leadership of the imams, the wilayat of the Ahlul Bayt." So these are the things that these are with respect to the actions that a person performed in this world. In continuation, the Imam said, our guardianship, our wilayat, will address the other four from inside the grave, saying, any deficiency that is in you, I will fill. Meaning, so if a person, you know, followed the orders and ordinances of the Ahlul Bayt, or it could mean that if he at least believed in it firmly, then the deficiencies that were contained in the other things, those other actions, will be fulfilled, will be made up for, and will be, will be made up for. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam also said, a person will not be questioned in their grave unless they have total pureness of faith or total disbelief. This is, of course, this could mean a number of things. One of the things that it could mean is that this questioning in the grave is not for each and every person. This is with respect to certain individuals. Some of our ulama have interpreted it in this way. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the questioning in the grave and what a person will be questioned about and who will be questioned in light of the hadith of the infallibles, alayhi wasalam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
From beautiful Tehran, a heartfelt salam to each of you. You're tuned in Iran Radio, and I'm your host here to guide you through an enriching day of discovery and insight. Please settle in. What you'll hear today just might make your day brighter. We begin this hour with further radio productions. Then join us for Bridge, a brief commentary on profound supplications, hosted by Sheikh Mehdi Dardashtian. Bridge offers a brief commentary and presentation of the supplications of the Noble Book of Sahifa Sajjadiya by Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him. Next, we open the door to Dialogue, hosted by Sayyid Shahriyar Naqvi. Dialogue is a look at the most important conversations and dialogues between Shia infallible imams with their followers, questioners, and leaders of different Islamic faith and sects on various religious topics and doctrines, and also political, social, and cultural issues. Following this, we'll feature more of our radio productions. Stay tuned. The next is another segment of our radio productions.
The hopes of the Palestinian people in Gaza to have a meaningful ceasefire are fading away amid the rising violations that have become a daily routine since the U.S. brokered deal came into effect. Until the moment of writing this report, more than 300 Palestinians lost their lives while hundreds others got wounded in the frequent violations and major escalations carried out by the Israeli forces. Those violations include the aerial and artillery strikes, mass shootings, and on top of that, the demolition of the Palestinian houses located in the areas beyond the so-called yellow demarcation line. Mahmoud Adurra, a 16-year-old boy from Al-Burwaj camp, was one of those victims who was targeted by the Israeli forces as he was trying to collect some wood pieces for his family to cook what to eat. To those who don't know Mahmoud, he is the youngest brother of the well-known martyr Muhammad Adurra, who was shot dead in his father's lap by the Israeli forces near Netzarim Junction live on air before the eyes of the whole world during the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Since that moment, Adurra's name has become a vivid testament of the brutality of the Israeli regime. Today, we are going to shed some light on the details of suffering that Mahmoud, like thousands of injuries, has been through since he was injured so far.
I'm Mahmoud Al-Durra, 16 years old. I was navigating along my friends in the eastern side of Al-Burraish camp to gather some wood in order to help my family. We used to do that for the last months. As I was walking there, suddenly I was shot in the leg. I tried to escape, but I fell down. Israeli forces came and kidnapped me alongside many friends of mine. Once they saw me, they identified me and told me that I am the son of Jamal Al-Durra. I was blindfolded and handcuffed tightly before the soldiers began to beat me savagely with their boots and fists. I was taken in one of their vehicles to an unknown destination. All along the way, they kept beating and insulting my father and me with all nasty abuses. They threatened me with killing my family.
In late of October, Mahmoud got out of our home to bring some wood we used to ignite the cooking fire, like all families of Gaza Strip do. I received a phone call informing me that Mahmoud had been shot and was seriously injured. We feared for his life, worried not only that he might die, but also that the dogs might tear him apart. In the afternoon, I received a phone call from the ambulance driver, who told me that Mahmoud had been released and was injured. I rushed to Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah. When I saw him, it was clear that he had been brutally beaten, with obvious signs of torture. In addition to the physical abuse, they insulted him, telling him that they had destroyed his home.
On the day Mahmoud was shot, I had a strong feeling that something was going to go wrong. I warned him several times, telling him I had a bad feeling and didn't want him to go. But he insisted on leaving, saying he wouldn't be far from home. When we received the call that he had been shot by the Israeli forces, all sorts of terrible thoughts raced through my mind. I feared that he would be left to die and eaten by stray dogs, or that the Israeli forces would abduct his body. My mind was filled with dark scenarios. To me, it felt like a miracle that Mahmoud survived, and I'm just grateful that he's still alive.
Although Mahmoud was only in Israeli custody for less than 24 hours, the horrifying details he and his family shared make it difficult to imagine the conditions that Palestinian prisoners and detainees have endured for decades inside Israeli jails.
One of the soldiers stuck his finger into the bullet wound in my leg, taking pleasure in hearing me scream from the pain. After that, another soldier opened a soda bottle and poured it into my injury. I endured more than 9 hours of relentless beating and insults with no break. Every time I asked for water, they would pour it over my head instead. At one point, one of the soldiers even stretched my arm out as if to cut it off, but the officer stopped him before he could.
Once Mahmoud arrived at Al-Aqsa Hospital, even more agonizing consequences began to unfold, revealing how the Israeli soldiers had deliberately caused the injury to his leg, leading to its amputation.
I was in shock when the doctor told me that Mahmoud's leg needed to be amputated or he would face life-threatening consequences. I begged him to do whatever he could to avoid the amputation and save his leg. Mahmoud underwent several surgeries, but sadly, all attempts were in vain. The doctor explained that the Israeli forces had deliberately treated his injury in a way that would lead to amputation. I couldn't believe that Mahmoud might lose his leg, and I burst into tears.
It was clear that he had been through hell in custody. He was insulted and brutally beaten. He told me that he would have preferred death over the humiliation and dehumanization he suffered at the hands of the Israeli soldiers. They deliberately caused the injury that led to his leg being amputated. They denied him food and water and refused to provide proper first aid. Can you imagine all of this being done to a 16-year-old boy? What happened to Mahmoud reminds me of what happened to his brothers, Mohammed and Ahmad, and to so many Palestinians who have been killed or mistreated by Israeli forces.
If all of this could happen to a 16-year-old boy who was only trying to gather some pieces of food, then what must the situation be like for the men, women, and community leaders of the Palestinian people? It's no surprise that many Palestinians feel that Israeli forces act with the spirit of retaliation and collective punishment, affecting even civilians who have done nothing wrong. For many Palestinians, the lived reality is that simply being Palestinian can expose a person to violence, humiliation, or abuse. And for those who choose to resist or stand against the Israeli regime, the consequences can be even more severe, sometimes extending to their families as well.
It was very clear that they shot me and took me because I am the brother of Muhammad al-Durra. They wanted to take revenge on my father for exposing them to the world. They told me explicitly that they were going to kill my family after destroying our home.
I know for certain that they targeted him because he is my son. They wanted to punish me for exposing their actions after the horrific crime they committed against my son, Mohammed, who was shot dead by Israeli forces while I tried to shield him with my own arms. There was no October 7th then. What happened to Mohammed was part of the ongoing violence and brutality that we continue to witness today in Gaza and elsewhere. In addition to Mohammed, the Israeli forces killed another one of my sons during the current war on Gaza. They also killed my brothers and destroyed my home. These crimes were committed simply because they see me as a problem for them, someone who refuses to stay silent. I have taken legal action against them in several countries, and they are trying to settle their scores with me.
It has become undeniable that everything the Israeli regime does to the Palestinian people, and every crime it commits against Palestinian children in particular, occurs within a specific context. Deterrence. The Israeli regime believes that by committing these crimes, it will enforce the Palestinian people to their knees, pushing them to give up their legitimate rights. However, the reality is the opposite. The Palestinian people continue to show defiance in the face of Israeli brutality, and their determination to resist occupation is growing stronger with each passing day.
I want to send a clear message to Netanyahu and the Israeli military. I will remain steadfast in raising the voice of the Palestinian people and pursuing accountability for the occupation until justice is finally served. No matter what has been done to us, our will cannot be broken. We are the indigenous people of this land, and we are fighting for our legitimate rights. Today, the entire world has become fully aware that the Israeli regime functions as a colonial system built on oppression. What has taken place in Gaza is a catastrophe of historic proportions. They targeted journalists, paramedics, and civil defense workers. No one was spared. Entire neighborhoods and essential services were destroyed.
It is truly heartbreaking that the killing continues even after the announcement of a ceasefire. Shortly after Mahmoud was shot, two other children from the same area were killed under similar circumstances. The targeting of children has become a devastating and recurring reality for our community. No mother anywhere in the world could bear the sight of her child losing a leg. Despite everything that continues to happen to us in Gaza, we remain steadfast. We will never give up our right to resist the occupation and to seek freedom and dignity.
Shooting Mahmoud will not be the last crime committed by Israeli forces, but it stands as yet another testament to the brutality Palestinians continue to face. An attempt to subjugate our people through fear and violence. Yet the Palestinian people will never bow or submit to the occupation. Our resolve remains unbroken.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdu wa thana. لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. May Allah bestow all of us with His mercy. He has already provided the highest level of blessing, and that is the wilaya and the guardianship of the Rasulullah and the Ahlul Bayt, His pure progeny. For that, if we spend the rest of our lives thanking Him for that and praising Him for that blessing, would not be enough and would not be sufficient. We've been talking about the 20th dua, the 20th supplication of Sahifa al-Sajjadiya, the great, the noble, great book, compilation of all supplications by Imam Zain al-Abidin, Imam Hussein ibn Ali alayhim as-salam. And the title of the 20th dua is that it's his supplication on noble traits, dua fi makarim al-akhlaq, and acts pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One of the greatest duas in order for us, if you want to spend time pondering upon a dua, Probably this has the highest priority because it focuses on the traits that have gone forgotten in our communities and societies. And it really helps recalibrating the compass to the right direction, inshallah, with the good deeds and with the good akhlaq. It says, it starts with this, Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alih. Oh Allah, bless Muhammad and his household. وَبَلِّغْ بِإِيمَانِ أَكْمَلَ الْإِيمَانِ. And cause my faith to reach the most perfect faith. وَاجْعَلْ يَقِينِ أَفْضَلَ الْيَقِينِ. And make my certainty the most excellent certainty. And we mentioned in the previous sessions, what are the three levels of conviction? What are the three levels and three degrees of certainty and yaqeen, right? Sometimes you know something is there by the traces of it. For example, you see the smoke, you know there's fire. Sometimes you see the fire, you're observing it by your own eyes firsthand. Therefore, you know that fire is there. This is ayn al-yaqeen. And the third one is that if your hand gets burned by the fire, you know that the fire is really there by experiencing it yourself, right? So these are different levels. But what are the signs of the people who have conviction? The Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam in different sets of narrations have explained that to us. If we take a short break, inshallah, I'll make sure to explain those signs after the break.
Salvation, a way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Respected brothers and sisters, asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the language of Imam Zain al-Abidin to grant us waj'al yaqini afdal al-yaqin, make my certainty the most excellent certainty. One of the things we have to look for in ourselves and in the people that we are going to have serious interactions with, right, dealing with,